This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Evening, everyone. Feel free to come in. Those at the back who are still making their way in, you're very welcome. It's lovely to see you all here tonight in this lovely, cosy, warm room. And aren't we all lucky that most of us here tonight will go home to a cosy, warm room and a cosy, warm bed? But of course, that isn't the case for a large number of Victorians. In Melbourne, in particular, in the CBD alone, the last street count found that there are 250 people sleeping rough on any given night here in the heart of our city. That's just in the CBD. That was an increase of 74% on the last street count. So the numbers of people in our community, the number of members of our society who don't have a home to go to, is on the increase. And of course, that headline number just is a very small part of the spectrum. The thousands of people, the 35,000 of people who are waiting for public housing in this state, and the thousands who are couch surfing, sleeping in cars, don't know where they're going to put their head from one night to the next. So homelessness and insecure housing is a very big and it's a very growing issue for Victoria and for Melbourne. And along with it being a growing issue, we seem to be seeing a growing intolerance of people who are homeless or who are having trouble finding housing. And that's what we're here to talk to about tonight, is how we are addressing this issue of homelessness and insecure housing as the government, Melbourne City Council, and as a society. You will all be aware, if you're interested in this issue, I'm sure, that Melbourne City Council is currently debating a proposal to effectively outlaw homelessness in the CBD. It's going to make it very difficult for people to sleep rough in the centre of the city. There was a lot of outcry about that, and some of the people on the panel here tonight were instrumental in working towards trying to change that. We are awaiting the outcome of that particular decision. So we're going to talk about that tonight. We'll also talk about some of the other examples from around the world, if there are any other solutions that we might think about adopting here in Melbourne. Other things to think about are the media, how the reporting on the various homeless camps, as they were called, around the city recently, whether that's contributed to a stigma of homelessness, towards homelessness. And is that justified? I mean, is there, as we are hearing, a growing aggression on the part of some people who have been seen begging in the CBD, and is that okay? And if not, what should we do about that? So these are all some of the issues that we're going to be speaking about tonight. We've got a panel, a very eminent panel, working in the sector here tonight to answer your questions. This is question time, and that means that it's not a panel discussion. It's your opportunity to ask questions of this fantastic panel for a full hour. So that is what we're aiming to do after I introduce them. I'll introduce myself first. I'm Madeline Morris, and I host the Question Time series here at the Wheeler Centre. I'm a reporter for 7:30 on the ABC in my day job. So let me introduce the panel, and we can kick off with some questions. Just in terms of housekeeping, we have ushers, so it's sometimes difficult for us to see you if you're putting up your hand. The ushers, please put up your hand and try and grab the attention of the ushers, and they will come to you and they will signal to me when they've got a question, and they'll range up and down. So we've got about 55 minutes left now, so enough with me. I'll introduce our panel and we can get going with some discussion. So let me start first of all with Jenny at the end. Jenny Smith is the CEO of the Council to Homeless Persons, which is the peak body here in Victoria. She's had a very long career in the public sector, working in policy, in health, in mental health, in community health sectors. She's also the chair of the national body, which is called Homelessness Australia. Michael Perusco is the CEO of Unison, which is one of the largest providers of community housing in Victoria, and he's also had a very long career working in the homelessness sector for various organisations, too many and too much of an illustrious career for me to go through all of them. Lucy Adams is the manager, just to my left here, is the manager and principal lawyer of Justice Connect Homeless Law. A couple of years ago, Lucy was lucky enough to get a Churchill Fellowship, travelling to 9 cities around the world, looking at homelessness and the regulation of homelessness. And so she's going to talk about a bit of that experience here tonight. And last year, she was the Law Institute of Victoria's Community Lawyer of the Year, and she has been with everyone else on this panel sort of organising a response to the Melbourne City Council. And I'm going to finish with the most important person whose experience we will probably most draw on this evening. This is Erica, sitting in between Jenny and Michael, and she is a homelessness advocate with the Council to Homeless Persons. Erica experienced sleeping rough, sleeping in private rooming houses, crisis accommodation, and now in public housing. And she uses these experiences to advocate for homeless people. And in particular, she helped to change the laws around private rooming houses to help to make them safer. And I'm sure she's very happy to go into that this evening. So, Erica, I might just start off with you with pretty much the question, and I'm sure that you get asked by everyone. If you just bring the microphone a little bit closer to you. So how is it that about 8 years ago now, you had a job, you had a roof, and then all of a sudden you found yourself sleeping rough? How did that happen?
Well, to put it in a nutshell, married, divorced, everything went into my work, relaxation work. I did that for 4.5 years until I had a meltdown mentally, physically and emotionally. At the time, it never occurred to me to go to the doctor or to my children. All I wanted to do was get away from everything and everybody. I found myself on my way. Where I was going to go, only God knew. I had 2 suitcases with all my worldly goods, hopped on the train, and the train started getting full, and I had a panic attack. I got off the train, sat on the station for hours, minus 1 suitcase, and then I remembered about St Kilda, how they had nightlife that always continues. So I came to a decision. I went to St Kilda, walked the streets, and then around 3 o'clock, all the lights were getting turned off. I didn't know what to do. So I walked down towards the beach. I found a nice, cosy little garden and with trees, and I planted myself under there. That was my home. That was where I felt safe. Mind you, I was always scared of the dark, but it taught me, if people can't see me, I can't see them. And that's how I survived.
And you lived rough for a little while, and then you moved into a rooming house. Can you tell us a little bit about those experiences of sleeping on the streets down there in St Kilda? How was that for you? It sound as though it was not too bad.
Well, it isn't. It's, you go through all the emotional things. What am I going to do for the day? Where am I going to go? When's my next meal? How am I going to have a wash? I was quite lucky that I situated myself next door to a public toilet at St Kilda Beach, and the council guys came and opened the toilets at 7 o'clock every morning. I rushed in there, had a wash, changed my clothes, and then I just put everything underneath the trees and covered it with dead leaves, and then I just walked the streets. In that period of time, I wasn't collecting the Dole or Centrelink. I just wondered. The first several days was a blur in my memory until I started getting hungry. And then I went to a 7-Eleven and I thought, oh, well, I'm hungry. I'll shoplift a tin of spaghetti. I thought it was great. I walked out. How am I going to eat a tin of spaghetti? I've got no tin opener. I had to throw that away. I went back in again and stole a hot pie. Unbeknown, I had a hole in my coat pocket, so that landed on the floor. After a while, I was really hungry. I went behind the restaurants when they closed and I went through their rubbish bins, and that was my meal until I got caught a week later. And the guy said, what do you think you're doing? I said, I'm having dinner. You know, and from that day on, I was really grateful. He left me a plate full of meal, and I had one decent meal. Yes, my health suffered while I was on the road. Yes, I had doubts. What am I going to do? But you just keep walking. I isolated myself from everything and everyone because I knew there was something wrong with me, but it wasn't the lifestyle I chose, but it was the lifestyle that I had to cope with because that's all I had.
I'm sure that many in the audience will have questions for you, Erica. So I'll just move on and introduce the other panellists, and we'll certainly come back to you. So, Jenny, that situation that Erica has just described there, sort of a conflagration of relationship breakdown, bit of a panic attack, and some issues with employment. I mean, how common is that, that people, when that conflagration of situations happens, that actually they just do end up in without a roof over their heads?
Yes, I think, Madeline, with the cost of housing out of control, I think, for people on low incomes, and low incomes not increasing at anywhere near the rate of the cost of housing, more and more of us are, you know, just a few pieces of bad luck away from finding ourselves, if not at risk of homelessness, then homeless.
Mm.
You know, a health issue, loss of a job, a relationship breakup, as Erica's described. You know, it's very, very difficult. Our, you know, services are groaning under the weight of demand. Here in Victoria, people, more than 100,000 people were seen by our services last year, and more than 20,000 turned away without what they were looking for.
And that's just because of a capacity issue?
That's just because of capacity, and because the tap that is running, that is driving homelessness, is probably getting turned on harder rather than getting turned off.
So you see the key driver of that as being the cost of housing to you?
The cost of housing and the impact it's having on very low incomes is undoubtedly the issue that we have neglected for, you know, 30, 40 years now, and we're now paying the price of it and seeing it pour onto our streets. And if you think that on our streets we're only seeing, in our parks, we're only seeing about 6% of the problem, there are many, many more people that we're not seeing, not because they're in the dark like Erica, but because they're in the backs of cars and in a range of temporary and unsatisfactory accommodation outcomes.
Michael, just explain what it is that Unison actually does for people, and how much your services are in demand at the moment.
So we do two things. Firstly, we provide what's called community housing, and community housing is essentially public housing run by not-for-profit organisations like ours, and we're regulated by government. So when you hear the term social housing, it means community housing, which is what we do, plus public housing. We also are the main entry point into the homelessness service system in Melbourne's west, and I'd certainly concur with Jenny's comments that our services are certainly groaning under the pressure out there, and certainly seeing in excess of 50 people and families through our homelessness service in Footscray.
Okay. And Lucy, your day job is basically helping out people who might be homeless, who have run-ins with the law and who need help. What is your view? How do you see governments at all tiers at the moment approaching homelessness and people who are homeless or in insecure housing?
So homeless law, we're a specialist legal service for people who are homeless or at risk. So we see that really pointy end of people being on the brink of homelessness, and like Jenny said, it doesn't take much these days to slip into homelessness. We've got a specialist project to keep women and kids in housing. 60% of those clients were facing homelessness just for falling behind in rent because the car broke down or the kids got sick. The other edge of it, so that points to people slipping into homelessness too easily, and in terms of government responses, that it relates to obviously investment in affordable housing and also your safeguards and your protections around eviction. So is eviction into homelessness in our community really a last resort at the moment, is one question we should be asking. And then the other end of it in terms of government settings and responses is, once people are experiencing homelessness and that their hardship is very visible, how is government responding? And we've touched on it already, and I think the audience will be really well aware, but one reaction from government sometimes can be to try and tackle homelessness with the law. And I think what we know through our work is that the law and the justice system is a really blunt instrument for dealing with homelessness. It is going to deliver the solutions that we as a community are looking for, and we do need to be focusing on what the alternatives are. And the alternatives we know are an investment in housing with that wraparound support that people need.
Mm-hmm. And investment in housing is something which is a huge issue at the moment. I mean, Eric, are you all right?
Yes, a smoker's cough.
If you need to pop off to go off stage to get a hot drink or clear your throat, feel free. Go right ahead. Absolutely.
Oh.
We'll keep your seat warm. So that issue of public housing. I mean, the list at this point in time is 35,000 people long, which is extraordinary. Children on that list, families on that list. What are all those people doing in the meantime?
So they're in the homelessness service system. So they might be in crisis accommodation or some sort of supported accommodation. A large chunk of them are in the private rental market and paying way too much in rent compared to their low incomes.
Yep.
And I think that's a real challenge for us in Australia. It's been a culture that's relied heavily on home ownership, and home ownership's been a big part of what we expect in our lives. That's getting out of reach for people. So the rental market is getting much larger, but it's not well equipped to meet that demand. So you're seeing a lot of competition at the lower end of the market, where people on higher incomes are trying to source the lower cost accommodation. So people on really low incomes are finding it very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And compared to people on higher incomes, don't make a great tenant on paper.
And do we have any clever ideas for how to increase that housing supply, particularly at the lower end?
So we know that the housing market is out of control. So housing prices have doubled over the last decade. We also know that during that time, the population has risen by about 17%, and public housing and social housing has increased by 6%. So you've had a housing market out of control, prices increasing, and a decrease in the amount of social housing. The only way to rectify that is increased investment by government in social housing, because for the housing market to work, you need the different components of the housing market to work. So you need home ownership to work, you need a private rental market, but you also need subsidised housing. The reality is subsidised housing is part of the housing market in pretty well every developed country. Ours runs at just under 4%, which pales into insignificance compared to other countries.
Right, okay. All right, well, look, let's start opening up the floor to some questions. Down the front.
Hello. Yeah, this one's for Erica. I was just wondering what kind of ways people who are experiencing homelessness can interact with them in a way that's not annoying them and that's really respectful, and yeah, that's pretty much it.
The way I look at it is that fact you like to be treat people the way you like to be treated, with respect and dignity. Look, there's good examples. Some will take it, some won't. Some will be abusive, some won't. But whichever way you look at it, at least you've got the dignity to say, would you not like a lending hand? Can I help? And that goes a long way.
Is it just about saying, can I give you a hand? Mm. Is there something you need? People often might sort of throw some money at you or throw a sandwich. How does that make you feel when you're sitting there on the pavement and someone puts down a sandwich or puts down money? Is that helping?
Well, I found for myself personally it did help me, because my health suffered. And you've got to remember, the people that are on the streets don't have the calling card to go to a doctor. So every little bit counts.
Okay.
But it does help. You forget your dignity when you're going through a rubbish bin for your dinner.
Absolutely.
So there's lower things than that, you know.
Is there anyone else here, if anyone doesn't mind talking about it, who's currently sleeping rough or who has experienced homelessness in the past, who might like to share a story? Did we have any other questions?
The cost of criminalising homeless people and banning them from sleeping on the streets is much higher than housing them outright. How do we explain to Melbourne City Council that kindness is economically rational?
I actually came across a great example when I was doing my Churchill in Canada, where they looked at this very question, and they looked at what the cost was specifically in relation to begging and squeegeeing. And they looked at it over the course of a decade, and just in relation to police time. So it takes about 15 minutes of police time to issue a ticket for one of those offences. They were predominantly being issued to young people experiencing homelessness. And they looked at it, they said 67,000 of those fines had been issued over that time. It took about 16,000 hours of police time. And the cost of that was $930,000. So it's almost $1 million. And then they looked back and $8,000 of those fines had been paid. So it's just one example. There are dozens around the world, although not a really robust analysis in Australia of that cost of criminalisation. But we know it is really resource intensive. We know it is a burden on our police, who are already busy with other pressing roles, on our courts, on our systems. And we also know that it doesn't work. So it doesn't make sense from a policy perspective, from a humane, compassionate perspective, or from a fiscal one.
Jenny, you might like to explain in more detail what the current proposal is from Melbourne City Council in terms of the approach to homelessness in the CBD.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth remembering that the situation we're facing in Melbourne came off the back of some poor media coverage of homelessness in our city, where one of our media outlets and associated media, you know, really took to demonising vulnerable people on our streets, and I think whipping up, you know, ill feeling among the population more generally.
Did you see a change? Did you?
Absolutely,
you did. Okay,
absolutely. And you know, it's been unconscionable behaviour, and we've seen it we've seen two waves of it, and I think we might expect to see another one. Mm. And in that context, you know, people sleeping rough in the city were offended, and supporters of those people were outraged, and that led to protests and in support, and to an overheating of what should have just been a difficult situation for people. So in that circumstance, you know, a range of things that mightn't have happened, and one of them was the City of Melbourne saying it would consider increasing regulation that might affect people's capacity to camp on the streets. So I think it's important to understand that circumstance and the pressure that a range of public officials were under in that context. The City of Melbourne has always taken a leadership role nationally in relation to how best to get the balance right between a humane response and public safety. You know, we all want to be able to walk down our streets, and we, I think, all want to be as humane as possible to people experiencing homelessness. My understanding is that the jury is still out in terms of what the council wants to do, and that it's not going to be responding until July. And I have some hope that we might see a response that focuses more on providing guidance around the amount of belongings that people can have with them camped on the streets, and perhaps less of an emphasis on making a difficult situation even more difficult for people.
But the changes are effectively that, the proposed changes are effectively that it would effectively outlaw camping within the CBD, and the second plank of it is, as far as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that people who may have left their belongings, those belongings can be seized, and they would need to pay $400 in order to get them back, which is clearly beyond the means of most people who are sleeping on the street. Otherwise, they'd be putting that $400 towards getting a home. So is that
we do have a range of charities who are bringing goods in for people all the time,
yes.
And that's intended with the best of hearts, but also creates a difficulty of a lot of goods on the street that people haven't necessarily bought there themselves.
Sure. And you've Would you like to talk through the proposal the alternative proposal that 54 organisations have put forward to Melbourne City Council?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as Jenny said, the City of Melbourne have always been a leader in their response to homelessness, and we've had the privilege of working with them on a number of projects, working closely with business and people who've experienced homelessness on our Women's Homelessness Prevention Project. So we recognise that it was only under a huge amount of pressure that they've moved and or started to go down this path. And I think everybody's on the same page in recognising that there is a very real crisis or problem that needs responding to. The only thing that's in debate at the minute is what's the best way of doing it. And so recognising that we needed a constructive response, 54 organisations have joined together and put together a 14-point plan that is got everything from your really short-term practical responses for people who are living their life in public, sleeping on our streets. Of course, the ultimate hope is that they won't be there for very long, but while they are, they do need storage. They do need kind of some guidance and support about their belongings and managing belongings in a way that does give access to all different members of the public. We do need to focus on communication and the role of the media and leadership and messaging and avoiding stereotypes around homelessness. There's a really great project that we hope could be scaled up, which is called Project Connect Respect, and that is this idea of working with people with a direct experience of homelessness and businesses to help understand homelessness better and communicate effectively with people experiencing homelessness, and also bring businesses in as part of the solution, because if homelessness is everyone's problem in the community. And of course, the final point in the 14-point plan is about housing, and it's long-term housing. People need to be moved into long-term accommodation where they can find their feet and they can be provided with the support they need to maintain that housing. And look, there has been a significant investment from the state government in the last 12 months, and I think it's 6,000 properties that will come online, social housing properties that Michael's spoken about, in the next 5 years, but they're not immediately available at this point, and it is a slow burn. It's a problem that's been developing over decades.
And just to put that... those 6,000 properties, that's a fantastic investment by the government. But to put it into context, for the public housing, for the social housing system to remain at its current proportion of the overall housing market, so to remain at that, it's actually 3.5% in Victoria, you've got to build or create 1,800 new units every year just to keep up. So never mind the 30 or 40,000 people who are on the waiting list, just to keep up. So that 6,000 is over 5 years, so it's not actually helping us keep up with population growth. Mm. And if I can just mention too, you know, we can relate that discussion we just had back to Erica's story. So if I think in terms of the media coverage, don't know, bear with me on this one, but when Erica was in the 7-Eleven stealing a pie or...
The tin of
spaghetti, you know, you could have been a Herald Sun with picture and all, a headline of this terrible homeless woman stealing stealing from the 7-Eleven, making the St Kilda streets all dirty. And you heard from Erica's story the context of all that, of all that was going on in her life. And I think whenever you see a headline like that, I think you have to remember the broader context. Yeah. And we all get angry. We all do silly things in our lives. And if we're unlucky enough to have a camera snap at that particular time, that ain't great for us. But it gets a lot worse if you're sleeping rough. And then on top of all your trouble, you would have got a ticket and a $400 fine.
Mm.
That's ridiculous.
Okay, next question, please.
Forgive my ignorance, but what actually are the laws associated with homelessness? Is it illegal to be a rough sleeper? Like, I don't understand the laws.
It's not. So it's not a crime to be homeless in Victoria, but there are a range of laws that are going to impact more harshly and more heavily on you if you are homeless. So we've got a range of different laws. The ones that most commonly affect our clients, and they can come to us with tens of thousands of dollars worth of these fines, include things like public drunkenness, having your feet on the seats, not having your ticket on public transport, smoking on the platform, littering, swearing, all things you're much more likely to be doing in public if you don't have a roof over your head. So they're the kinds of laws that we're up against currently in Melbourne, and Jenny's touched on the laws that are being proposed more at a local level.
Just on that point, though, I mean, I don't like it when people put their feet on the seat, and I don't like it when people smoke on the platform and I'm pushing my baby around, and just because someone has an unfortunate backstory, why should the law not apply to them in the same way that it would apply to me if I did that?
And look, we certainly say in relation to aggressive conduct, for example, that there are existing mechanisms. But as Michael said, that we do have to be mindful, both in as a community, I think as a legal system, of what it is that contributes to the conduct. And in fact, the law is set up in relation to infringements. There's a particular provision that says if it is your homelessness or your mental illness or your substance dependence that affected your conduct so heavily that it influenced what you were doing, it impacted on your decision making, then we will waive the fine. But the problem is it's a really difficult, expensive, protracted process to go through, and that's for the individuals. It's stressful and also places a strain on the system.
And so of those people who you work with who presumably have no capacity to pay if they have tens of thousands of dollars of fines. First of all, I've got two questions. One is, what impact do those fines have on their behaviour, and does it deter that what could be seen as antisocial behaviour in the first place? Mm. And second place, sort of, what are you able to do for them, given that they have very little capacity to pay?
Yep. So in terms of this question of deterrent, it's an important one. I think we got a sense from Erica of just what it is like day to day. You're just trying to get by, and the decisions you might make are pretty different to the decisions you'd make if you weren't under those same pressures. So the kind of more punitive approach doesn't have the same deterrent effect as if I, for example, get a Mikey fine, then I will be really, really deliberate in my activities from that point. It's a whack for me, but ultimately manageable. But that is not... that kind of decision-making, weighing things up, isn't what's happening for most of our clients. And normally our clients have got a mix of circs, but if they've entered into homelessness, that makes it really hard to keep your mental health on track and can lead to escalating substance use. So there can be overlapping factors that are affecting decision-making that a fine isn't going to make a difference. What we do know is that it increases the stress and increases that feeling of being overwhelmed and increases the feeling of humiliation and helplessness. Mm. In terms of what we can do, once people come to us and they're in a position where they're wanting to resolve fines, and it's often after people have entered housing and the crisis and the chaos has shrunk a little bit and they're ready to deal with them, we start this really long process. So going about unpicking the fines, pointing out what contributed to the underlying conduct, going through the courts a couple of times, getting a couple of supporting documents. And often at the end of the day, those fines are waived and the person is allowed to move ahead with their life.
Did you ever have any experience of that, Erica? Any sort of run-ins in the law of that sort of ilk?
No, you've got to remember, when I was homelessness was a stigma. It was a shameful thing. We never showed our face like the young ones do today, like they do at Flinders Street. So no one knew I was homeless when I was walking the streets, and no one knew I was happy, you know, in that simplistic lifestyle. So, yeah, we didn't have the... I didn't have the personal experience of coming across breaking any law in that, because I was too busy trying to hide away from everybody.
Yeah. It sounds as though... from what you said, that you feel as though there's been a sort of a change amongst...
There is a change. Yeah. With homelessness today, it's not a stigma. It's brought out into the open. And also, under the same umbrella, you've got homelessness with couch surfing, you've got homelessness in cars, you've got homelessness, you know, with people who sleep on the streets. So there's different types of homelessness. And also, you've got to remember one thing. We never chose this type of life. No one gave us a pamphlet on how to cope in being homeless. Mm. Circumstances led us to being homeless. And you've got to have the understanding and the patience, you know, because that's the main thing that will get us all by is, you know, have understanding and the patience of getting on with each other. If we've got, you know, we've got to help each other. If we don't do it, no one else will. That's all it boils down to.
Do you think that there's less of a stigma, Jenny, now around homelessness? Is that your experience and the experience of your the clients who work for the of the organisations that you represent?
Well, I think the community is more aware of it and in some ways more aghast of it, but also more accepting that it's there and more interested in what the possible solutions might be, although tending to focus a bit more on what, you know, the crisis responses are, rather than making sure that every political party that we vote for has an appropriate policy in place and a commitment to expending the funds that it's going to take to start to turn off the tap for homelessness.
We do sort of tend to applaud the, oh, 300 extra beds here, 500 extra beds here, which is great on the cheaper end of the scale and not addressing the systemic issues that you're talking about.
Well, I'm not even sure that it's cheap because, you know, every 300 beds we put in, there's a 300-place caravan park on the outskirts of town closing down. And if you think about it, if you want someone to go into a shelter or a crisis accommodation and stay there for 2 weeks, then you need to think, where is the permanent home for them at the end of that? And so for every crisis or temporary accommodation bed, if you only want people to be there for 2 weeks, that means you need 26 permanent homes each year. And we tend to focus a bit more on that short, sharp, how do we get Erica out from under that tree end, not how do we get the 26 people who are going to be in that crisis bed this year into a home. And we need to focus on both. They're both very important. But, you know, we sit here tonight without there being any national strategy at all to do anything about this. We have a Victorian state government that's made a huge commitment in response to family violence and a significant commitment in relation to rough sleeping, some of which will hit you know, is hitting us now, but quite a bit of is on the, you know, longer lead time. But federally, we're very much focused on trying, have been focused on trying to retain the funding that we currently have, supporting our public housing and our homelessness services, and trying to make sure that we don't lose that. Not on where is the low cost housing strategy and the taking our effective homelessness services to scale around the country.
So how much do the feds contribute then to social housing?
$1.343 billion.
So that is that
is for our 2/3 of that is for our current social housing.
Okay, so is that a larger proportion financially than the state governments?
Do you know
it is? Oh, okay. So no? the feds fund it and the states implement it. Is that the deal?
It's a bit of state matching.
Okay. So for that money, you'd think that there would be a more cohesive.
Well, it's been
plan.
That money for a very long time.
Yeah.
And it hasn't gone up.
Okay.
No, and that money is spent on things that are happening already. It's not spent on producing that pipeline of subsidised housing where people pay rent but it's subsidised, that we need for the lower end of the spectrum. And we're still relying on the private sector to somehow magically produce it.
Yeah.
The private sector has the last 30, 40 years to show that it can do that job. I think it's unequivocally a magnificent failure. So we can't keep relying on private developers to be interested at the bottom end of the market. They are not. And government will always have a role in providing subsidised housing. We need to get on with it as a community, or we will just be running around doing, you know, nice crisis things.
And just in terms of that lack of a federal plan, and I'll go to a next question after this, but I think this is quite an important question. I mean, there's always this issue with key problems such as, or key sectors such as housing. What is the state's jurisdiction? What is the federal jurisdiction? They don't want to step on each other's toes. They would like the other one to fund it better. I mean, is there a solution to that? I mean, do we need to make it a nationwide policy and portfolio and approach rather than what it is currently, which is much more of a state-based?
Yes, we need every level of government to work together. But it is pretty clear. I mean, the federal government would provide the bulk of the funds for additional social housing. The federal government needs to tackle the very politically difficult issues around taxation subsidies for negative gearing and capital gains tax.
Right. You see that as being key to the issue.
Yeah, it's not a magic wand, but this is a problem of the Western world, but the rest of the Western world doesn't have that inflationary push that we do.
Yep.
Why are we doing it?
Yep.
Why are we doing it? It's not. It may have been intended to help initially, but it's clearly making things worse. State governments need to be doing a range of things, but, you know, they should be doing inclusionary zoning. Every time we do a development or a redevelopment, why are we not having 10 or 15% of that as affordable, a mix of affordable and low-cost social housing, subsidised housing?
We're not, as you see in other places
in the
world.
As we go. Why have we got, an amazing redevelopment like Fisherman's Bend that doesn't have social housing in it, but we do. So right around the country we need to be doing that as well. Governments do need to work together, but it does require federal leadership, and we have a lot of talk but no action.
Did you have a final word on that, Michael, before we move on to the next question?
I don't think the jurisdictional issue, I don't think that's really an issue. I think it's about recognising in Australia we have a public housing system in each jurisdiction that is broken, so it is not working well, properties aren't being maintained, etc. There isn't enough money to invest, and it's also, so the second point is, it's broke. There isn't the funding to make it work. So the $1 billion that's coming from the Commonwealth at the moment and then what the state puts in, that really goes to maintaining what is old stock. We need to recognise that in order to change that, we need significant investment, and it is in the order of $2.5 billion a year. But you look, and that's across the country, you compare that to other expenditure of government. It's not a huge amount. It is a manageable amount.
How many submarines is that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's
probably part of a submarine.
But if we don't do it, and this is the point, it's a slow burn issue. So, you know, the public housing system, social housing, has just been getting worse and worse and worse, and governments have been able to ignore it. I think what we're seeing on the streets of Melbourne, that's a physical manifestation of the housing crisis, and it's only going to get worse unless we see that level of investment. And Jenny's right, you need the federal leadership, you need more of what the state's doing, and it's about building, it's about recognising that the rents you get from public housing doesn't build more housing, it just allows you to maintain it. You need extra money to build.
Okay, where's our next question?
So I've got two questions. The first for Lucy specifically. In your time travelling, what did you find was the most successful evidence, most innovative evidence of how to deal with the homelessness problem? And then what was the least successful? And then next sort of general question. I'm a doctor in a hospital where we deal with catastrophic healthcare problems when we have patients with no fixed address. That's where they end up, at the Royal Melbourne commonly. And I'm noticing more and more there are no GPs that offer bulk billing services. What health services are available for the homeless in general?
My example that I'm really interested in at the minute is Los Angeles, because when I was travelling in 2013, they were an example of worst practice, probably. They had the highest concentration, and still do, I think, in the United States, of people sleeping rough. There were about 5,000 people in a 50-square-block area called Skid Row. That was a gentrifying area previously that crew of people had been somewhat out of sight, out of mind, but as that community changed, there was an increasing appetite for enforcement and increasing pressure on decision makers. And they took a really heavy-handed law and order approach. So they did have a law on the books that prohibited sitting, sleeping or lying on the sidewalk. And as dictated by that policy and that pressure at the time, they enforced that very heavily. And one woman I came across had been charged 60 times for sitting on the same corner. And she was homeless. She had a serious mental health condition. She'd done a stint in prison. She'd come out and she was back on the corner across the road. A lot of money was going into enforcing these laws. They have now come the full circle, and just in the last 6 months they've introduced in LA, I would say, quite progressive amendments that will that recognise the importance of housing and housing with support, and that will generate revenue. And their hope is that the revenue generated through a couple of different taxes will generate a supply of about 40,000 properties over the coming decade. So they've come the full circle, and they're probably my example of most interest at the minute.
Health services. Erica, did you want to talk about health services?
Well, there was no such thing as health service when I was on the streets. I just made do with what I could and how I could. The only thing is, every now and then I'd go to the doctors with a snivel, and I had the flu, and that was about it. So hot toddy, go to bed under the trees, and that was it. Life was good.
So bulk billing GPs, Jenny?
Look, we do have a few specialist health services. We're very fortunate to have the Royal District Nursing Services long-term expertise. Yeah. In working in an outreach capacity with people experiencing homelessness, and co-health auspices and inner city.
That's inner city only?
And health service. But I think the important thing to remember is that there isn't an electorate in our country that doesn't have people who will be homeless tonight. And I still find that a sort of strange idea, but it's true. And so the health needs of people experiencing homelessness are right across our country. And that's why nearly every health service does find that it's responding to people experiencing homelessness. And that is why we have many, many people experiencing homelessness, whether we can see that or not, or whether, like Erica, it was harder to tell, sitting in our emergency departments as much for shelter as for their health needs, because nobody deals with their health. No one deals with their diabetes or their heart condition and remembers to have the medication with them, or their mental health medication. Yeah. If you're homeless, there's only so much you can have with you.
Can I just go back to the questioner? I mean, so if we could just get a microphone back to this chat back here. So you clearly, are you seeing an increase in sort of symptoms and severity of symptoms in people who don't have homes in the hospital that you work at?
Presentations of patients to the emergency department who have no fixed address are incredibly severe, and they've got multiple health problems that can't be solved in a single emergency department visit.
But could have been solved had there been earlier interventions with
reasonable
a regular
follow-up with a GP who offers them, you know, chronic healthcare plans that are incredibly difficult to deliver when you don't have a fixed address.
Yeah.
So we're more likely to have a discussion about how to increase the capacity of our emergency departments, our hospital beds, our mental health beds, our prisons, than we are to have a conversation about how we provide safe and ongoing homes for those people. If we tackled the discharges into homelessness out of all of those points of community contact, we would make a very big impact on in slowing the growth rate of homelessness in our community, but we're not focusing on that.
No. All right, our next question.
I'd like to hear a little more about some of the experiences you had overseas and what is happening in other places, because it seems to me with all the development that's going on in Melbourne, whether it's as I live out in the Broadmeadows area, where at one time that was public housing. Yeah. In the court that I live in now, there are only two of those houses now are in public ownership. The house that I lived in, came out of public ownership a number of years ago and is now worth $500,000, which is ridiculous. And yet, what happens to those people? I would suggest that in in pulling down of old buildings and the building of these townhouses, so-called, I don't see any provision within them for public housing. And I wondered if that is being considered in other parts of the world.
Mm. So to go back to Los Angeles, it is, and there is that recognition that our health system, our justice system, our crisis systems are so heavily impacted if we don't invest in housing. So we are getting to that point. I think I saw the mayor of New York say homelessness is a very expensive problem. So that, unfortunately, in addition to the human recognition and the clear human cost, this pressure on other elements of the system does prompt recognition that we need to invest in housing. I think Los Angeles is where they are saying, kind of, I don't know whether it's going to be run by the state or the local government or whether it will be not-for-profit organisations running it, but ultimately it's subsidised housing with supports.
So in London, when you build a new development, a percentage has to be affordable housing, social housing. And that's not required here in Australia. I think the reason is that governments are, that they believe the property industry when they say that introducing that will cripple development. And I think it's about government recognising that for what it is, and that's property developers seeking to maximise their profits, which is fine, that's their job. But government's job is to say, no, you're actually making enough profit out of the housing market as it is. We need to make sure that we see 10 to 15% of what you're developing as social and affordable housing. And we know that getting that mix is a lot better than building large concentrations of public housing.
But, I mean, that's been the case in London for donkey's years. But
yeah,
there's
and
been
hasn't...
No...
in it's been
no
fine.
Indication.
Yeah.
Well, I've lived in London for a long time. We lived just around the corner from public housing in my very...
So it's accepted.
Nice neighbourhood around that, and it was just... everyone. I think that's the key thing. Everyone accepts it, right? Because it's been going on for so long that's just the deal, and everyone knows that it's the deal. Whereas in Australia, people who are homeless have been isolated for so long, like Erica in the park, or we just haven't had the numbers, or they live out in places where people don't see them, that we just don't recognise it as being an issue that we need to tackle.
No, and I think where, if you don't mind me saying, Erica lives in a mixed tenure community, so it's in which actually we manage. So there's public housing alongside private housing. It was a large public housing estate.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anymore. It's mix of private and public, and you know it works well. I walk through, and I think I'd love to live there.
That's what he keeps saying to me. Yeah. Live in my shoes, mate, and you'll find out different. But it's like all things, you know, the government promised you the world. 10 years later, I'm still asking for more affordable housing.
Mm.
It's not there. They're not listening. That's why you've got a lot of young bucks out on the streets. Okay, they make it more noticeable. They might go around it the wrong way, but in the long run, people are taking note. We all need affordable housing, no matter who we are, whether it be my kids, my grandchildren, or your children. Everybody needs a safe haven, no matter what. I wasn't born with a gold or silver spoon in my mouth. I worked. My children work. So is my grandchildren. Except for one, still smokers cough. But, I got one grandson, ice addict. He comes to Nan for support. What do you do? All you can do is be there for them. Don't do this, don't do that. They still go ahead and do it. And with it, they bring all sorts of trouble with them. The lies, the cheats, stealing.
Lucky he's got you there and a cup of tea and some biscuits, no doubt, and a listening ear when he needs it. We're almost out of time, but I just wanted to take a couple more questions, if I could, please.
At the beginning of this year, there was a report in the Weekend magazine of The Australian about a guy who had a very, very bright idea of refurbishing empty railway carriages that just sit there at night. And it was going to cost, from memory, about $30,000 to refurbish a railway carriage. The idea was that they were going to work in conjunction with the City Council. My concern as I walk through the city is those people who sit there, and I don't know that they're going to be safe overnight. I spoke to one young woman recently and I said, what's going to happen to you tonight? She said, I'll take a train out to, and I think it was somewhere like Box Hill, and she said, there's a rotunda there and I'll be okay at the rotunda. I've got a case manager, but I'm on a waiting list. My sense is I'd rather her be in a warm, refurbished railway carriage where some support people could go in, find out her needs, be able and be there to support her one way or another, but she's not on the street where she's very vulnerable and available to violence.
So that's an option? Is that being looked at as a live option?
Well, I think we know that we have in Victoria at least 23,000 people in some circumstance along those lines tonight. And I think we do need to continue to be creative and generous in the way that we come up with crisis safe havens for everybody who's experiencing
homelessness. I hadn't heard of that particular plan. Is that something that's being considered actively?
The railway carriages, containers, office buildings, car parks. Many, many generous and thoughtful people in our community are trying to think about how to come up with these temporary arrangements. But I go back to the point I made before, is what happens in the morning and also what happens as more and more people need that outcome. And so for every train carriage, which might have, 10 people sleeping in it, we need those homes to follow. The other thing with the temporary arrangements is that you end up with a group of people with significant challenges in their lives in the same place. It can create significant challenges. It's not camping and it's not a share house. Mm. It's people who are down on their luck and having a hard time, might be struggling with mental illness, might be struggling with addiction, definitely struggling with poverty and often with a history of some trauma. It's not an ideal situation. It's certainly in some circumstances will be safer than the streets. We've all spoken with people who've actually said that some of these temporary arrangements are actually more frightening than being on the street.
Right.
Particularly shonky rooming houses. Yeah. So people choose not to stay there because they're, with a group of people and in a being ripped off sort of circumstance, that is much scarier than actually being under the bright light on a shop front.
Yeah. Yes, next question, please.
Thank you, all the panellists. In the lead up to this vote at council in July, I'm worried about the psychological and emotional impact on people if these new laws do go through. We've already seen so-called camps, disbanded and groups broken up, the vilification by the tabloid media. How does that affect the people that you know psychologically and emotionally, feeling like they're unwelcome and they should be out of sight and they should be punished? What's the effect on them going to be if these laws go through, do you think?
Erica, would you like to take a stab at that one?
Well, to be quite truthful, people who have got emotional problems more or less go around in denial. You've got to remember, a homeless person's lost everything. They're down in the bottom of the ladder. They lost their family. There might be sons, daughters, mums, dads, homes, everything, even monetary. So some do get help through certain organisations like PESP, St Vinny's, CoHealth, and with CoHealth they do bulk billing, so, you know, some do get do get the help.
So if you were told when you were living in St Kilda, you can't stay here, we don't want you here, and don't leave your sleeping bag there, because if you leave it, it's going to cost you $400 to get it back. What sort of effect do you think that would have on you as a person?
Well, for me, I'll rebel against it, because as far as I know, the sidewalk's public.
Right.
And that's why I look at it. I mean, to say, why should I be condemned for making a home on a public footpath? That's the only thing I've got. No one knows what we go through until you live it yourself. Mm. And then when you live it, you know what it's like to lose everything. I'm quite fortunate. Bess gave me the education, and St. Vinny's gave me the balls to speak up for homeless people. Because for a simple fact and reason, we're all trying to work together into having affordable housing, food, where we can get that, because you go to Flinders Street and you've got a lot of organisations with soup vans doing barbecues and everything. We go to PESP for, you know, they might, have you got any homes there? You know, little things like that. Once you get into the system, you can work your way out to having a home that you call your home, that you can lock the door. No one can intrude on you. You're safe.
Can I ask you, when you did finally get that home, which you can call your home and you can lock the door and you're safe and you've got the things that you love there, how did that feel to you? How did that change you?
To be quite truthful, the first 8 months, I couldn't sleep in it. It took me that long to try and acclimatise myself in the actual flat. I slept on the floor because I couldn't sleep in a bed.
Wow.
Yeah, it takes a long time to adjust. Also, it took me a very long time to adjust my neighbours. You know, as far as I was concerned, I was out. I had the freedom to come and go as I pleased, no one around me. I had that isolation. When you got neighbours next door and they're coughing and everything, oh, what are you doing, Jack? I'm doing the washing. What the hell is that, you know? But you get used to your neighbours, and now that you introduce yourself, you know, oh, she's a normal bird, you know, she'll be right, mate. You know, you turn around and say, okay, that's life. You accept it. You make good of a good bad thing. And half the time it's not as bad as you think it is. And I've been really blessed that I can actually come up here and talk and promote homelessness, because without it, no one will know what we're going through.
Well, Erica, thank you very much for sharing those experiences with tonight with such eloquence and openness. We really appreciate it. Thank you. And you've given us something to all think about it next time we see someone who is hard on their luck. Thank you. You know, we'll all think about the backstory that they might be experiencing. So we've gone a little bit over time. Thank you for bearing with us. And thank you very much if you could all join together in giving a round of applause to our panel, Jenny Smith, Michael Polisco, Lucy Adams and Erica. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.